This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Leslie Waters, and my guest is Michal Kshinyan, author of the new book, Milan Rostislav Štefánik, the Slovak national hero and co-founder of Czechoslovakia, published by Routledge in 2021. Welcome, Michal.
Hello, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
So let me tell you a bit about our author for today. So Michal Kshinyan defended his dissertation in history in 2011, summa cum laude, receiving a joint PhD between the University of Paris Pantheon Sorbonne, where he later lectured, and the Institute of History of the Slovak Academy of Sciences, where he currently works. He's written several books about Štefánik, edited or co-edited 5 volumes, and published dozens of scientific papers on various topics. His works have been published in Slovak, French, English, Italian, German, and Russian. He's the recipient of several prestigious scholarships and awards, including the prize of the President of the Slovak Republic for the Best Student of Slovakia in 2011, a Fulbright in 2014, and the Slovak Academy of Sciences European Research Council Visiting Fellowship Grant in 2021. Since June of this year, he's a member of the Presidium of the Slovak Academy of Sciences. So to get started, Michal, I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners, who was Milan Rostislav Štefánik, and how did you become interested in writing his biography?
Yes, to present him, Leslie, I think it would be very useful because he's not very much known abroad. In Slovakia, he's very, very much known. But in Western Europe, let's say for ordinary people, he's completely unknown. So he was born in Slovakia in 1880, what was at the time Upper Hungary. And he studied in Prague, in Czech Charles University, astronomy. After the end of his studies, he started his scientific career and left for Paris, where he started to collaborate with prestigious or accomplished scientists as Jules Janssen or Henri Poincaré. Well, he was a great traveler because one of the main topic of his research was the solar eclipses. So he did a lot of expeditions all around the world because so probably you know and you can observe the solar eclipse always from different or solar eclipses always from different spots of the planet. But after several attempts, failed attempts to find a stable job in France, he took a very important decision, and he decided to build his own observatory at Tahiti, which was or which still is now at the time it was French colony and now it's part of France. After the beginning of the war, he became a military pilot. In spite of his very bad health, and he was fighting mainly in Western Front and in Serbian Front. But by the end of 1915, he started to collaborate with Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk and mainly with Edvard Beneš, and they organized Czechoslovak movement abroad. Mainly, they founded Czechoslovak National Council. And the main project of this Czechoslovak movement abroad was the creation of the Czechoslovak legions. That was the army of that fought on the side of Entente armies against the Central Powers. What's also very interesting about Štefánik, he became a general only within 3.5 years. It was not due to his military activities, but mainly due to his diplomatic activities, because of course he was fighting for for independent Czechoslovakia, but he was a French citizen, and France supported this project. And in order to boost his prestige, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs always insisted to promote Stefanik in higher rank. But he died tragically shortly after the end of the war in 1919, and in airplane crash while returning to his, let's say, liberated homeland, as he used to say it. So he died shortly afterwards. And how did I become interested in his biography? That's actually a funny story, because I studied history and French language at Comenius University in Bratislava. And my Professor Letz, told me that, Michal, do you want to do the research about Stefanik in France? I said, oh, okay, why not? At the time, I was a little bit more interested in medieval studies, but I said, okay, so why not to go to France and to study there? And then I learned the opportunity was opened at Sorbonne. And then I learned how this idea came up, because there was one professor of theatrology, Mr. Mistrik, who was in touch with professors at Sorbonne. And the professor at Sorbonne, Mr. Marais, he was writing the biography of Edvard Beneš. Mr. Subigu, his assistant, was writing or wrote already the biography of Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk. And as you, Leslie, probably know, and maybe also our listeners, we Slovaks are always like to compare ourselves to Czechs. And so he was teasing them. Oh, one is writing the biography of Masaryk, another is writing the biography of Beneš. But why are you not writing a biography of Stefanik? He was French citizen, and so on and so on. And they told him that if you want someone to write Stefanik's biography, you have to send us someone. And it happened to be me. And I published Stefanik biography in French 2 years ago in 2019. So, well, and it's the book that we are talking about. It's a little bit reworked version of this French biography. So this is how I became interested in writing Stefanik's biography.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about sources with you before we get into the sort of the substance of your book. So in your introduction, you mentioned that you conducted research at Slovak, Czech, French, Italian, British, American, and Russian archives, among others. So what types of documents did you consult to write this biography, and how did they help you to reconstruct aspects of Stefanik's life?
Yeah, one of my ambitions was to study all the relevant documents about Stefanik. So I tried to do as much research as possible. It took me a really long time. And I think I saw all the relevant documents about him, except maybe for Russian archives, because, well, maybe you know, access for foreign researchers to the Russian archives, it's not always easy. Mm-hmm. But when I went to Moscow in 2012, my friends from Russian Academy of Sciences recommended me to the director of the military archives, and I went there. And there was a very nice lady. She brought me all the necessary papers, and to take one picture of any document, it cost €5. Mm-hmm. So it was extremely, extremely expensive, because there was a lot of documents. But she was very nice, and she left me with all those documents alone. But I didn't have enough courage to take the pictures of those documents, because, well, you know, in Russian military archives, even before 2012, I was afraid of being accused of being foreign spy. But, well, fortunately, our Russian colleagues published two volumes of documents about Czechoslovak legions in Russia. So thanks to their work, I could base my research also on Russian archives. But if someone will be willing to look more in details in Russian archives, I think it could be very useful. And as about the nature of the documents, I think mainly in Slovak and Czech archives, I found the personal papers of Štefánik. So it helped me to reconstruct more some like personal features of Štefánik, but in archives in France, in Italy, or in Great Britain, or in the United States, those documents were more of an official nature. So it helped me to reconstruct more or less like some this like, let's say professional activities of Štefánik.
Great, thank you so much. So you have a mix, I suppose, of these kinds of diplomatic documents or military documents,
yes.
And then you have these personal papers that give you an insight into his personal relationships and. Yeah, I know you write a little bit about how he's like kind of a Casanova type figure, very successful with the ladies. So it really is an impressive body of work that you've come up with.
Oh, thank you.
So as I read your book, I was struck by how similar of a man Štefánik was to somebody like Fridtjof Nansen or even Benjamin Franklin, these famous scientist, explorer, diplomat personalities. So can you tell us about Štefánik the scientist and his big contributions to scientific field and projects?
So Štefánik was son of a Protestant pastor. So he believed in God very strongly, you know, in this really typical conservative Slovak rural society. But great turning point occurred during his studies in Prague, where he lost his faith. And at the time it was quite common, and with the progress of the secularization, and he saw the opposition between science and God. He thought that he didn't think that God is anymore, or the Christian faith is anymore to answer all those important questions. But it's gonna be the science that will give us all important answers. So, but later he just later, of course, he a little bit changed his opinion. But as I mentioned already, Štefánik studied astronomy. He did a lot of missions all around the world, and his scientific career was quite decent, let's say. He was not the best astronomer of the time, but he published a lot. And if we take into consideration that he was not able to focus himself on his scientific career, I think we can say that he did a pretty good job. But the most important project, a pre-war scientific project, was the establishment of Tahiti Observatory at Papeete. The capital city of Tahiti, and that's why he moved from a little bit from his scientific activities towards diplomatic ones, because he was aware that just a simple astronomy just a simple observatory would have some problems to gain the support from state officials. So he wanted to join his observatory with wireless telegraphy station and weather forecast service. And as he always thought in very broad perspectives, he wanted to create a worldwide wireless telegraphy net. It was also the ambition of the France at the time, because France wanted to join all the colonies, all its colonies all around the world, with wireless telegraphy network, and so he wanted to create observatories and wireless telegraphy stations in several countries, but in order to connect Tahiti with Martinique, that was another French colony, he needed some station in between, and he chose Galapagos Islands. Because belong belonged and still belongs to Ecuador. So he did a pretty important diplomatic mission in this country. He wanted to boost French influence in this country. He wanted to acquire one of the Galapagos Islands to France. Well, from diplomatic point of view, it was not a great success, but from scientific point of view, it was more successful. But what's also very important, he got the cross of the Knight of the Legion d'Honneur, and this very important French state recognition. And that was before the war, and after the war, he became a military pilot, and he came or he make up a lot of inventions, or he wanted to improve several military equipments, mainly related to the aviation. Mm-hmm. But his most important scientific project during the war was that he created a military weather forecast for one section of French front. That was under the command of General Foch, later will be very, very well known, Marshal Ferdinand Foch. Mm-hmm. And as I already said, Stefanik was not satisfied with some local partial solution, so he wanted to create inter-allied military weather forecast service. We don't have very much details about his activities, but we know that in his personal papers in Slovak National Archives, we can find the records from the military, from weather forecast from Greece, from Romania. By the way, in Romania, it was Stefanik who founded it, this military weather forecast service. From Italy, from France, and from some other countries. So that was important to underline that he always thought in very broad perspective, and it was this switch from scientific activities towards diplomatic ones.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you so much. So diving into your second chapter, this is where we start to see some of the methodological choices that you've made in order to analyze Stefanik. So you use Pierre Bourdieu's concept of social capital to analyze Stefanik in chapter two. How do you use this concept, and what does the framework reveal for you about Stefanik?
Yes, great. First of all, allow me to do some preliminary methodological remarks for our listeners. Well, the structure of my book is not chronological; it's more thematic. So, when I choose four different approaches that analyzes various aspects of Stefanik's life, but and by doing this, I wanted to offer to the readers complex and complete picture, or maybe rather pictures, of Stefanik. And what was the real challenge for me? That on the one hand, I wanted to capture all the how rich and extraordinary his life was, and on the other hand, I wanted to stay faithful to my profession of historian, and to stay on, I wanted to be stay analytical. So this was really really very tough, very very difficult to not write some apologetic biography. And my basic question is how Stefanik became a Slovak, or the Slovak national hero, or more broadly, how someone become a national hero. So, and one of the responses is that one of the chapter, the main four chapters, I used the concept of social capital of Pierre Bourdieu, because Stefanik had a lot of friends and acquaintances. And I took this social capital as a tool to analyze it. I wanted to capture his ability to profit from his networks. And it's this concept of social capital helped me to show that it's not if I meet someone, it's not only this first meeting that is important. It's also very important, but it's also this maintaining of this relation, as Pierre Bourdieu. As Pierre Bourdieu wrote it, that we have to maintain this social capital by investing an effort, money, our knowledge, and so on and so on. So this process of maintaining social capital is very important. And what's also very very interesting about Štefánik was how he transformed his social and cultural capital into economic one. But I will come to this point later. I think that Štefánik used three different tactics in order to maintain and to accumulate his social capital. First of all, it was direct or professional contact. Well, if we take an example of Jules Janssen, a famous French astrophysician, Štefánik was expanding his work. He was building on it, so he was pushing his heritage further. That's why that was one of the reasons why Janssen supported Štefánik. It was also well. We could could. I can give. Other examples, but I don't think it's that important now. Another important contact is family contact, because as Bourdieu states, this family is the crucial place of reproduction of the social capital. And first of all, it was of course Štefánik's family, but then later on it was all those families in Prague or in Paris where he went in 1904, and. So, for example, Štefánik met there, let's say, Senator Émile Chotin, but it was not only the senator who supported him, it was the whole his family, and his daughter, Yvonne Chotin, fell in love with Štefánik. They got engaged, and the son of Émile Chotin helped Štefánik to find some financial support in the ministries, and so on and so on. So it was not only one person, but it was the whole family that supported him. And last contact, I think it's very important in the case of Štefánik, is mediated contact. Mm-hmm. Because I said already, before the World War One, Štefánik traveled a lot, but after war broke out, he traveled even more. But he needed to, he had to be at least some symbolically present in different places. So let's say when he was negotiating green light for the creation of the Czechoslovak legions in Rome, he was traveling every 2 weeks to Paris in order to maintain his strong position in French society. Or he used different strategies. For example, it was mainly Benes who represented him in France, or he had another person who kind of maintained his influence in those milieus. And as a case study, I can mention that Štefánik, it was Štefánik who got rid of Josef Dürich. It was another important Czech politician who went abroad during the World War One, and he wanted to lead the Czechoslovak movement, but he wanted to do it more of a pro-Russian way. Štefánik and Beneš and Masaryk, they were not happy about it. And I reconstruct how Štefánik used his contacts from French Ministry of Foreign Affairs to let's say journalist in American Czech and Slovak community. So he really mobilized his social capital in order to discredit Dürich. And by the way, Dürich had much more. I would say Dürich had much more. Give me a second to find the right word. Because he was the deputy of the Reichsrat, I think his authority was much stronger than the one of Štefánik, because Štefánik didn't have was not a deputy. But anyway, Stefanik succeeded to get rid of Dürich and thus unifying the Czechoslovak movement, because it was not easy to unify it. And not everybody wanted to respect the leading position of Stefanik, Beneš, and Masaryk. And as I mentioned already, the process of transformation is social and cultural capital to the economic one. Stefanik built his observatory in Tahiti, and it cost 250,000 francs. It was really a lot of money. Let's compare it to Stefanik paid a rent for his flat in Paris, in rather poorer neighborhood in 14 district. It was 650 francs per year. So we can really see that he was very successful in this transformation. In this transformation of this social capital into economic one.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that's really fascinating. Especially, you know, as you say, to take this social capital and outmaneuver essentially the more legitimate, perhaps, Zurich when we're talking about the First World War. And I also think it's what it really separates this, or allows you to write a biography that deviates so strongly from what we might consider hagiography, right? So so pushing these sorts of sociological concepts has been, I think, really successful for your book.
Thank you. That was one of my ambitions in writing it.
So I have a similar question for you for your third chapter, which focuses on Max Weber's idea of the charismatic leader. How do you use this concept, and in what ways does Stefanik meet the criteria for you of a charismatic leader?
Yeah, I was thinking about Stefanik and thinking about memories and reminiscences on him, like when a lot of people mentioned his heroism, his brilliance, his high ideals, his high values. I was looking for some tool that would allow me to analyze this side of his personality. And Stefanik presented science and French influence before the World War I as values that were worth it of support. And during the World War I, it was the so-called liberation of the Czechoslovak nation. And he was putting himself in the position of let's say intermediary, because he said that, well, by supporting me, you are not supporting me as a person, you are supporting these high ideals that I am fighting for, and those ideals are worth of the support. And by this way, he was showing a way to the better future for a society. But we should also keep in mind the historical context that was very, very favorable to the progress. People were impressed by scientific progress, by the secularization, and Stefanik was kind of symbol of it. He was symbol of the modern times, because he was specialist on wireless telegraphy. He was an astronomer. He was a meteorologist. He was a military pilot. He was a traveler. He was a great speaker. He was a great romantic seducer. And well, if you had this kind of people came walked in to some salons in French capital or in Italian capital, he captured very easily the attention of the people or of the public. And well, also some, let's say, some ordinary things for normal people he was able to turn into his favor. Well, let's take an example of his health issues, because he had very serious health problems during all his life. And he took several surgeries during the war, and also before the war, and so on and so on. And when people were telling him that, come on, Stefanik, you are too sick, you have to get the rest, you have to, because if you continue to live like this, you're gonna die. He responded that, oh, now it's not time to rest. Now it's time to fight for the freedom of my people and of my country. And it really worked, because when we read, for example, some memories of French people that knew him, they were saying that more Stefanik, or when the health of Stefanik was getting worse, the idea of Czechoslovakia was getting, or the prospect of the creation of the Czechoslovakia were getting better, and they were saying that he was almost giving his life to the idea of the birth of Czechoslovakia. And it's also important to stress that he was a great storyteller, and he was a great seducer, as we mentioned already. But he really enjoyed this process of seducing. He was not as much as Don Juan, even if he really liked women. But I really liked one of his stories that he used to say in French and Italian salons, that he was charged observing a solar eclipse in one remote small island in French Polynesia. And when he came to this island, he called or found the local chief of the local tribe and told him, "My friend, we have a big problem. We have a big problem. The sun is gonna disappear tomorrow. But don't worry. The French government is aware of its duty towards its own citizens, and French government is sending me, so I will make sure that the sun is gonna disappear, is gonna reappear tomorrow." And of course, he was an astronomer. He knew very well when the solar eclipse took place. And so the next day, everything happened as Stefanik predicted, and the local chief was really amazed, enchanted by this magician who was able to make the sun reappear. So that is one of the stories that Stefanik was telling in Paris and in Rome. But of course, today we are not able to know. We are not sure whether this happened this way as Stefanik told it, or rather I would say I'm sure that it didn't happen this way.
Yeah.
But it is not important, because as we know now that Stefanik was exaggerating, the people at the time, they knew as well that he was exaggerating. But in the same time, they knew that before this exaggeration, there is a lot of life experiences, there is a lot of travels, there is a lot of knowledge, and so on. So it was a way of boosting his position in this society that knew that he was exaggerating, but it was not that much important.
Right. Yeah. So another example of sort of instrumentalizing one's capital here. He's had life experiences that others haven't. So I want to talk now about Czechoslovak politics and the ways in which Stefanik became involved. So you describe, and I found it very interesting, like in contrast to James Ward's recent biography of Tiso, who definitely changed his political and kind of ethnic identity over time. Stefanik seems to be somebody who is very assured of his Slovak identity throughout his life. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he was involved in the Czechoslovak project always. So how does he become involved in Czechoslovak politics?
Yes, it's very interesting. I think Stefanik is in a very particular position because, he's in Slovakia. I think we will talk about it later. He's seen as the national hero, but he's not really part of Slovak history or of Czechoslovak history, as he lived all his active life in France, like from 1904 until 1919, all those 15 years. He was almost not present at the time it was Austria-Hungary, but what was later Czechoslovakia. So it's really interesting position. And but this involvement in Czechoslovak politics, I think it has its roots in his studies in Prague, where he met Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, and he was hugely impressed by him. Masaryk was a great professor. He was admired by his students, and Stefanik was was one of them. And also during this time, Štefánik started to think that Slovaks should more cooperate with Czechs from political point of view. And he was also during his stay in Paris before the war, he was all the time in connection with some Czechs. So this connection to the Czech society was really strong. And after the war broke out, he acted rather alone. He wanted to create an air squadron composed of Czechs and Slovaks that would fight on the side of Entente or in the French army. But the real turning point here is his meeting with Edouard Beneš, as I mentioned it already in 1915, and he started to collaborate it with Beneš, Masaryk, Dürich, and these four people, as I mentioned already. They get rid of Dürich soon after, but they created the Czechoslovak National Council, the central body of the Czechoslovak movement abroad. And their main goal was the political reconstruction of the Central Europe, mainly the dismemberment of Austria-Hungary and the creation of Czechoslovakia. They were saying that that they wanted to create or recreate Poland at north, then Czechoslovakia in the middle, and Yugoslavia in south. And they wanted to join Czechoslovakia with Yugoslavia with this famous corridor, because they were arguing that Austria-Hungary was not anymore able to stop German drang nach Osten. Of course, we all know that the main enemy during the World War I was Germany, but the Czechoslovak National Council and the Czechoslovak movement abroad was arguing that the real problem is the Austro-Hungarian Empire, because through this Austro-Hungarian Empire, Germans can realize their expansion towards the east. And by recreating this Central European space, by creating Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia, that would be allies of Entente, those states were supposed to be able to stop the German expansion towards the east.
So how does he compare then to the two Czech founding statesmen, Masaryk and Beneš? So he works, obviously he collaborates with them closely, but he strikes me in how you wrote about him as a quite different type of person.
Yes, he was definitely really very different from Edvard Beneš. Edvard Beneš was a real politician and diplomat. I mean, it's really different to find another aspects in his life. So Masaryk is more complex. Of course, he was a great philosopher, but he was also a great politician. But this I would say this human aspects of Štefánik is very striking. But if we speak about, say, political history, I mean, the Štefánik died soon after the birth of Czechoslovakia. He died in 1919, and he was not able to take any important political position in Czechoslovakia for any length of time. So that's why Beneš and Masaryk are much more known abroad than Štefánik. Mm-hmm. Also, it is I think important to mention that memories of Masaryk and Beneš were wrote after the World War I, and they were translated into French and into English. So that's one of the aspects that plays against Štefánik, because of course when you were reducing credit of one of the co-founders of the Czechoslovakia, it increased the credit of the other co-founders of Czechoslovakia. But my point, or I don't think the task of the historian is to defend the position or activities of one particular person or historical person. But this Štefánik contribution to the establishment of Czechoslovakia, I see mainly in two spaces. It was mainly in France, because at the beginning of the Czechoslovak movement abroad, so it means in 1916, because the real progress was made mainly in 1918 from the Czechoslovak point of view. Štefánik was really crucial in France. He knew all the most important politicians. He was received by the president of the republic. He got, thanks to his activities, thanks to his diplomatic activities before the World War I, he knew all the most important politicians in France. And another important contribution of Štefánik was in Italy, where he was able to change the very negative position of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Baron Sonnino, towards the Czechoslovak movement. But it's always well, there was a lot of conflicts about Beneš and Štefánik, mainly about the question who is going to be the number two after Masaryk. But mainly in, let's say, in Slovak historiography, we some historians forget that their cooperation was great. Even Louise Weiss, that was a famous French feminist and journalist who fell in love completely with Štefánik, she said that she never saw two person that hated that much each other, Štefánik and Beneš, but their cooperation was amazing. So when if we are looking at it from broader point of view, as the Czechoslovakia was established in 1918, we should say that their cooperation was really efficient.
So can you tell the listeners about the Czechoslovak legions a bit more? I know you already discussed, but it's such a critical part of the sort of founding mythology of the state. So tell us about the legions and Štefánik's role in founding them.
Yes, Štefánik played a crucial role in their founding. Well, the Czechoslovak legions was its official name was the Czechoslovak Army Abroad. And it was composed of the volunteers that were recruited mainly among the prisoners of war of the Austro-Hungarian army, and those prisoners of war were of course of Czech and or Slovak origins, and those volunteers were also enrolled among the compatriots, among the Czechs and Slovak compatriots living abroad, and this project of the Czechoslovak legions was the central and the most important project of the Czechoslovak movement, because by creating this army that were fighting against its homeland, they were it was very very particular situation. So there the Czechoslovak movement was showing that Czechs and Slovaks in the Austro-Hungarian Empire are not happy with their destiny, and they wanted their liberty. And Štefánik played a crucial role those legions were created in France, Italy, and in Russia. And Štefánik played a crucial role in all those three countries. Let's begin with France, where Štefánik was active in negotiating this permit or this presidential decree that allowed the creation of the Czechoslovak army or the Czechoslovak legions in France. But the main problem of the Czechoslovak movement in France was that there were not prisoners of war of the Austro-Hungarian army, but simply because France didn't have a common front with Austria-Hungary. So Štefánik had to do a lot of missions. He went to Russia, to Romania, to the United States, to Italy, in order to find the volunteers for this Czechoslovak legions in France. And in the end, there were around 10,000 soldiers in the Czechoslovak legions in France. In Italy, I think this Štefánik's Italian mission is the most important. Is his most important mission during the war, because Italy didn't like all this whole movement of the nationality, the so-called nationalities of Austro-Hungarian Empire, simply because the Yugoslav movement had the same territorial demands as Italy on the Adriatic coast. So Italy was refusing all, not only the just Yugoslav demands, but also Czechoslovak demands, say Romanian and Polish demands. And Beneš did several missions in Italy. He wanted to convince them to allow the creation of the Czechoslovak legions in 1917, but he was not very successful. And in 1918, Štefánik came there. And after 1 month, he convinced the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Baron Sonnino, to give green light to the creation of the Czechoslovak legions in Italy. It was in April 1918, and if you want to compare it, for example, the Romanian and Polish legions were allowed to be created only in August of 1918. So it shows us that Štefánik mission was very successful. And finally, there was around 20,000 Czechoslovak legionaries in Italy. And the last country, it was Russia, where the situation was the most complex if we compare it to the two previous, or was much more complex than if we compare the situation to the two previous countries. Štefánik did two missions in Russia, first in 1916-1917. Thanks to his activities, this new Russian provisionary government allowed creation of the Czechoslovak legions, but later, soon after, Kerensky, the Minister of War, changed his mind and the recruitment of the among the prisoners of war was not allowed anymore. And then Štefánik came to Russia in 1918. In November, he left the European continent in August 1918. So during the war was still going on here. But when he came to Russia, he did almost the journey through the whole world, because he went to Vladivostok through the United States and Japan. Mm-hmm. And when he came there, the war was already over. And the Czechoslovak legions were fighting against the Bolsheviks. During the war, their aim was to recreate the Eastern Front after the signature of the Brest-Litovsk Peace Treaty. And after the war, there were supposed to be the core of the inter-allied intervention army to Russia. But of course, they were not very much motivated anymore to fight this war, because Czechoslovakia was already created. It was already in November, and as we know, Czechoslovakia was created on 28 October 1918. And the things get turn out even much more complicated when pro-monarchic Admiral Alexander Kolchak took power in Siberia, and those Czechoslovak legionaries were much more left-wing orientated. So they didn't really like this new political situation. Štefánik came to Russia with a little bit naive idea. He wanted to fight his way through Russia through to Czechoslovakia and to liberate it to liberate Czechoslovakia this way. But after several visits of the units on the front, he realized that it was not anymore possible, and he ordered the Czechoslovak army to retreat. At the time, he was already the Minister of War of the newly founded Czechoslovakia, and there was also a lot of the situation of the Czechoslovak legions was very complicated, because before the birth of Czechoslovakia, it was a voluntary army and it has an autonomy. So it was very interesting that it was special council of the soldiers that was taking the military decisions. So this military hierarchy didn't apply for the Czechoslovak legions. But after the creation of the Czechoslovakia, Štefánik wanted to reorganize it into regular army, and this regular army was supposed to obey its government and mainly its Ministry of War, Štefánik. But Štefánik understood that he was not able to resolve this problem in Russia. So he came back to Europe and he started to negotiate with Marshal Foch in order to retrieve the Czechoslovak legions from Russia. And there was really a lot of them. There was around 60,000 legionnaires.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. So I now want to turn to a discussion of the issues of citizenship and belonging, which you describe in some depth throughout the book. So how ultimately should we think about Štefánik from this perspective? Is he best to be considered as a cosmopolitan citizen of the world, or should we follow his French citizenship? Should we take into consideration his close links with Italy, his Slovak ethnic identity, his Czechoslovak political orientation, or maybe even something else? What do you think?
Yeah, that's great, and at the same time, very complicated question. Because, well, if as I mentioned already, Štefánik traveled a lot. He was born in Slovakia. He did his studies in a lot of small towns all around the Hungarian kingdom. His university studies he did in Prague, then he moved to Paris. He got a French citizenship in 1912. His fiance was Italian Marquise Giuliana Benzoni, and so on. He was a scientist, so this led him to some sort of cosmopolitan feeling. So his whole life was typical to this multiplicity of his identities. Because usually we think that people, mainly if we speak about the national identity, people can have one identity because, well, I'm Slovak, he is Hungarian, he is, I don't know, whatever. But mainly, this stereotypical vision. But we know that there was mainly in Central Europe, with all these multi-ethnical societies, people could have multiple identities. And Štefánik was, in the same time, Slovak, and in the same time, Czechoslovak. He really liked all Slavic nations. He was French citizens. He said that I will be willing to die for as much for Slovakia as for France. And when he was at the top of Mont Blanc, where he did astronomical observations, he wrote that he's a cosmopolitan, and so on. But one of the ambition of my chapter was that in the historiography, often his Slovak identity and Czechoslovak identity are presented as contradictory. And in the same time, his Slovak identity and his cosmopolitan identity are presented as contradictory. And I wanted to show that these Štefánik's identities were not contradictory. They were much more in harmony. And in the same time, as I can be a guy from Bratislava, Slovak, Central European, and whatever European, it doesn't mean that one should contradict another. But it was rather those discussions about the nature of Slovak identity in general that influenced the stereotypical representations of Štefánik's identities.
Yeah, this is so important. Thank you. it actually is like a major contribution also to the debates that the Central and Eastern European historians have been having about national indifference and all of these sorts of ways of talking about people. Here you have somebody who's the Slovak national hero and even doesn't necessarily fit easily into a categorization of a very strict national identity.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so it's great because, you know, most of this research has been done on kind of everyday people, not like non-politicians, but even that you can find examples of this among the elites is really fascinating. So I want to start to close things out by talking a bit about Štefánik's death and the controversies surrounding it that you detail.
Yes, Štefánik's death is definitely the most discussed topic about Štefánik, because this plane accident wasn't properly investigated after it occurred, and what led to a lot of conspiracy theories about who shot him down, why was it so, and so on and so on. Like if we do some kind of I can say it, neutral historiographical analysis, there is not any proof that can show that Štefánik was assassinated or something like this. If all the evidences available today, if I take them into consideration, I can easily say that it was a simple accident. But those discussions, as I mentioned it already in my previous questions, those discussions about Štefánik's identity, but mainly about Slovak identity, I think they led to the creation of two concepts of Štefánik. On the one hand, we had a Slovak concept of Štefánik, and on the other hand, we had Czechoslovak concept of Štefánik. And these two concepts has three important characteristics. First of all, this Slovak concept is saying that Štefánik's identity was Slovak one. Maybe he had this ethnic identity, he was Slovak. Maybe he had this political Czechoslovak identity, but it's not important. On the other hand, this Czechoslovak concept is saying that Štefánik's ethnical and political identity was Czechoslovak, that he was a real Czechoslovak, he didn't believe in any Slovak nation, and his political identity, I don't think that anybody can discuss this, his political identity, because he was really Czechoslovak. And then the second characteristic is that as Štefánik, as Slovak, as ethnic Slovak, this Slovak concept, he wanted that Slovakia has an autonomy within Czechoslovakia. On the other hand, this Czechoslovak concept says that, obviously there was no reason to have for Slovakia to have autonomy, as Štefánik didn't consider Slovaks as a specific nation or people. And this led to the third characteristic that I think that is the most important, and those are the relations on one hand between Štefánik on one hand, and on the other hand between Beneš and Masaryk, because this Slovak concept says that those fights between Beneš and Masaryk on one hand, and on other hand Štefánik, were about the autonomy of Slovakia, and if Štefánik didn't agree with the centralized Czechoslovakia, they were supposed to assassinate him. So this is Slovak concept is saying this. And on the other hand, this Czechoslovak concept is saying that Štefánik didn't have any conflicts with Beneš and Masaryk, and so thus they didn't have any reason to assassinate him. And also this harmonical life between two Czechs, or one Moravian Masaryk, one Czech Beneš, and one Slovak Štefánik, was a symbol of the harmonical or of the harmony of the nations or the people living in the in the Czechoslovakia. Of course, there was let's say explanations of Štefánik's life, of Štefánik's death, mainly by communists or anti-Freemasons. But I will not go deeper in this. But I will just like to explain this Czechoslovak concept and this Slovak concept, because this Czechoslovak concept, it was Štefánik was very useful because it could uproot Slovaks from its from their Hungarian past, because Slovaks were part of the Hungarian kingdom for at least 900 years, and showing Štefánik as anti-Hungarian was very helpful to this Czechoslovak concept in order to uproot Slovaks from their Hungarian past. On the other hand, Štefánik and his harmonical relations with Beneš and Štefánik were symbols of the positive identification of Slovaks with Czechoslovakia. On the other hand, this Štefánik Slovak concept could play the same negative role towards Hungarian past for Slovaks, but as he was supposedly assassinated by Czechs, negatively identify Slovaks towards Czechoslovakism and later towards Czechoslovakia. So this Slovak concept of Štefánik, he deals with the two most important challenges of the creation of the Slovak identity. It was the negative identification towards the Hungarian past, and Slovak identity had to respond to or find its position towards the Czechoslovak identity. I think those were two crucial points of the creation of the Slovak identity in the 20th century.
Great. So we've taken up quite a bit of your time, but I do have one substantive question left, and then we'll do the sort of standard ones. The last chapter of your book is dedicated to the historical memory of Milan Rastislav Štefánik. And I'd like you to maybe briefly describe for us what the trajectory is of how he's remembered and what his place in Slovak national memory is today.
Okay, thank you. I will try to be as brief as possible. As Štefánik in the interwar period, he was seen or he was presented as a hero. Of course, there were statues of him erected all around the mainly all around the Slovakia, but also in some cities in Czechoslovakia, also in France, in 16th district in Paris, there is still Štefánik Square. But the great turning point came in 1948 with the communist takeover. Because according to the communist explanation of history, Czechoslovakia was not born thanks to the support of the Western countries, but thanks to the Bolshevik Revolution, and so communists wanted to break down this bourgeois legend of the creation of the Czechoslovakia. And what played in Štefánik's disfavor was also that he fought against Bolsheviks in Russian Civil War. There was a short exception during the political detente by the end of 60s. So this is also known as Prague Spring. But during the normalization, this traditional position of communist continued. But funnily enough, if Štefánik was denounced by unpopular regime, I think it only boosted his popularity.
Mm-hmm.
Today he's seen as one of the most important person of Slovak history. In every sociological survey, he is among three top personalities. Most often, he's on the top. And in 2019, that was public poll called the greatest Slovak. So the question was the greatest Slovak, and Štefánik of course won it, but he won it. He among the top 10 personalities, he won half of all votes. So it, yeah. It really shows us that that he was really popular. But we have to take into consideration that it was the centenary of his death, and it's also interesting that Štefánik's death. Death is much more commemorated than his birth. So this gave him a lot of place in Slovak public or mediatic discourse. And also year before, in 2018, it was the centenary of the birth of Czechoslovakia, where Štefánik, from Slovak point of view, was the crucial person. So two subsequent years, he had really strong position in media cover, and he was in all the important speeches of politicians and so on and so on. So I think it really boosted his popularity. But there is no any doubt that Štefánik is very popular among Slovaks.
Great. So to finish up today, I just want to ask if you have any recommendations for recent books in Slovak or Eastern European studies that you would recommend to listeners?
Yes, I really like the book of Jiří Hutečka. I think I think New Books Network already interviewed him, Man Under Fire. Mm-hmm. But I would recommend also the book of Gabriela Dudeková-Kováčová. She's a colleague of mine in the Institute of History of the Slovak Academy of Sciences, and she wrote the book Človek vo vojne, People at War, and this is the first social history of the World War I in Slovak society, and as far as I know, her book will be soon translated into English, so even those who doesn't speak Slovak, I think there is a lot of our listeners that don't speak Slovak, they will be able to read her book in English. And I can also recommend another collective volume edited by Jakub Drábik. It's called Operation Danube Reconsiderate. So it's Operation Danube, as maybe our listeners know. It's the invasion of Warsaw Pact armies into Czechoslovakia into 1968.
Great, thank you. Those both sound really wonderful. And then what projects are you currently working on, Michal?
Well, now I'm trying to write rather social history of French military missions in Central Eastern Europe from 1914 until 1938, because France sent a lot of military missions in Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Greece, and so on and so on. And from political point of view, I think those missions are political, diplomatic, and military point of view, those missions were already greatly analyzed, but I would like to analyze them from the point of view of the social history.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So this has been Michal Kšiňan discussing his new book, Milan Rastislav Štefánik, the Slovak national hero and co-founder of Czechoslovakia, published by Routledge in 2021. And it's This talk has been brought to you by the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Leslie Waters. Until next time.